One of the themes that I've been reiterating, while we studied Yetzias Mitzrayim, we didn't deserve to be redeemed, we were intransigent, we were intoxicated with the pagan culture, we were stuck in the mud, and yet Hashem redeemed us in a way that wasn't anticipated, that wasn't neatly packaged based according to simplistic human anticipatory messianic expectations. It was very, very different. And in the first Beis HaMikdash, all of a sudden, Yeravam ben Yoash, who was this wicked king, he led to grand territorial expansion because Hashem saw that the boundaries of the Jewish people, again, it's not exactly your stellar, all-star leadership coming in with Gemaras and Sifrei Torah, teaching us the ways of Hashem and leading us to this grand redemption on clouds of glory, but Hashem chose Rishayim. And then, of course, we talked a little bit about Hanukkah and the restoration of Jewish sovereignty being spearheaded by a dynasty that, quite frankly, was in over its skis, and then usurped the throne, and they were punished, and, of course, they were big tzaddikim, and they were Moshe Nefesh HaKadosh Hashem, but within two, three generations, they were known more for infamy than for, or at least equally infamous, as they were famous. Again, not to compare them, but this wasn't the tzaddikim gemurim that we would expect. Now, the common thread in all these areas is that that's not exactly the way we would have written the redemptive narrative. If you and I were to sit down and write it out, it wouldn't exactly have gone that way. We'd look back at Mitzrayim and Hashem would come and say, throw away and cast away your pagan idols. And we'd all go, we toss them away. Throw away those pagan idols. Hashem said yes, and I'm tossed. Not exactly what happened. We rebelled, we refused. And then all of a sudden, the first Beis HaMikdash, we need a redeemer. Who's going to redeem us? I don't know. David, Shlomo, Yoshio, Chizkiah, plenty of good choices. And who does Hashem send? Yeravam ben Yoash. And then you'd expect the Chashmonaim to go down as the greatest heroes in the history of the Jewish people, and they saved us from Greek culture. And that's not the way it ended. Namely, all of our geula seems to be very atypical, very irrational, very illogical, very almost counterintuitive. Nothing is as it seems, and nothing unfolds the way we would expect it. It seems very mysterious, very odd. You know what? If you think that, you're absolutely correct. Geula is odd. And let's find three prophets, not really three, two and a half, two who are actual prophets, and one who had prophetic capabilities, but he just lived a little too late. And I've got all these prophets who just live in the wrong period of history. But if they lived in the right period, they'd probably be a Navi. So we have two and a half prophets who got this. One of them was Yirmiah. We'll see Yirmiah. One of them was Zechariah. Okay, actually, yeah, Zechariah. Half of one was Rabbi Akiva. So let's follow the trail of this prophetic sense that Gula isn't really predictable and rational. And you'll see, it's not an aw shucks, I wish it were, but it's built into Gula. It is not something you can predict or apply logic and ration to. So let's start with Yirmiah. Parak Lamed Beis, as you girls told me, source number 4. Listening, I'm a good teacher. I listen to my students. I do whatever I'm told. We're starting with source number 4. And Yirmiah is standing in Yerushalayim. And Yerushalayim is falling apart. This is the first Beis HaMikdash. The Babylonians have already broke through the walls. There's a lot of disease. Remember, this is ancient warfare. It's not like you press a button and you go from quiet stability to death and carnage in 10 seconds or 10 minutes. This is a slow burn. Death, pestilence, starvation, body, stench. I mean, like Siege Yerushalayim. We know the Siege Yerushalayim lasted, at least according to Chazal's timeline, 10 months. From Asar B'Tevis, it's 8 months to Shavasar. These are 8 months of no food, no water. It's a hard scene. So the city's falling apart. The city's deteriorating pretty quickly. And then Hashem tells Yirmiah that day that I want you to deliver a prophecy. And I want you to deliver a prophecy. Are typically clean up a little. It's a nice learning environment. A clean mind, clean space. So we think that prophecies are delivered by tongue and words. You know, sometimes Nevi'im deliver prophecies through their actions. And sometimes the actions are very iconic and very symbolic. And today, in Yerushalayim, the day that Hashem speaks to you, please close the door, the day that Hashem speaks to Yirmiah, it's a little too late for words. Hashem says, Yirmiah, I want you to deliver a prophetic vision, but through actions and deeds, not words. Thank you. So what does Yirmiah do? Hashem tells Yirmiah, I want you to go and purchase land in Yerushalayim. I want you to go through all the processes and methods and hoops and ladders of buying land and write a contract and put it into an earthenware vessel because that's how they used to store their contracts. So it shouldn't be burnt. And there's like their safety deposit boxes. And I want you to go buy land. And Yirmiya is like cracking up. He doesn't know what to make of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. One second. Are you sure you know what you're talking about, Kadosh Baruch Hu? He says, I'm making it humorous. We'll read the Sukkah in a moment. Buying land in the city of Yerushalayim, which is ablaze and fire, and people are marauding. Like you can't. It would be a joke. It would be like going to, I don't know, to Fallujah during the height of ISIS, or to Hiroshima the day after they got nuked, and saying, "Can I purchase some land?" Like people don't know what to do with you, to make of you. You're purchasing land. This place is about to be conquered. It's in the process of falling apart. There's no market. There's no lawyers. And Yirmiyah looks at Hashem and says, "You know, I'm a Navi. I get you. I get the fact that I can't get you. I've been through Eov a couple times. But this is completely absurd. It has to make some sense. I know that we can't understand your ways, and your ways are not our ways. But buying land in Yerushalayim, it's ridiculous. You're asking me to perform something which is a completely, completely irrelevant action." And Hashem says, "Exactly. Now let's read the conversation." Perek Lamed Beis in Yirmiyah, source number 4. For Espalel El Hashem Acharei Titi Esefer HaMikne El Baruch Ben Neri El Nimor. After I went through this like charade of purchasing land by giving a Sefer HaMikne, which is a contract, I turned to Hashem and said, like, I'm a good guy. I'm a good servant, a loyal servant. I did it, but like, I can't stop cracking up. Like, I'm making it humorous. I don't get this. This is like an empty charade, an empty act. What does he say? Aha, Hashem Elokim. Now, girls, the words I'm about to read in the name of Yirmiyah, these are basically taken straight from Eov. As Eov wrestles to understand divine injustice, divine mystery, divine unknowability, all that stuff, he uses these words. So Yirmiyah is essentially saying, I'm a Navi, I know Eov, but this is still ridiculous. So what does he say? Ha, Hashem Elokim. Hine ata sisa sashamayim v'sa'aretz b'chachacha gadol v'zrachayin t'ya. Listen to this word, it's going to be important. Lo yipalim v'chal kol davar, nothing is hidden from you. Gadol haitzav v'rav haliliyah, the great possessor of wisdoms and the great master of narratives. I mean, this is all classic Eov. Asherei necha pikuchot, source number, you may as well read if you haven't read Eov. These are good Eov-like lines. Asherei necha pikuchot, al kol darkei b'nei adam, l'seish l'ish k'darko, l'fir mal alav. Your eyes are constantly surveilling and you compensate and you reward. This is all, you know everything, I know nothing, all set up. But now, line number 5. Hine. Hasololos bo ha'ir l'lachta. But now let's get real. Tachlis. The ramparts, right? How do you break through a city? One of two ways. Either you build a rampart, right? Ramp, and you go up the ramp, and then you can scale the walls. If you're really skilled, you build like these long, big towers on wheels, and you move them forward, and you're able to climb the walls. You got to get up. So I remember they build the solos, whether they were ramparts. They could have been battering rams, really. I don't mean a battering ram like you'd have in your closet. Huge, huge battering rams that were attached to pulleys and just battered down these big stone walls. But something, solos is something to break down the wall. Once the solos get near the wall, it's over. The whole drama is, do you get the solos near the wall? Do you not? Once the solos near the wall, you're dead. So you got to make sure they don't get near, but they're near, which basically means game over. You know, solos bari l'lachda, it's about to be captured. V'er nitna b'yad akastim. Now, the costume is very interesting. The costume were the mercs. You know what a merc is? Mm-hmm. Mercenaries. Every good army has its mercenaries. Right? What makes the situation in the Ukraine today so difficult to process? Because obviously, from a humanitarian standpoint, these are people who are suffering. These are innocents. They've been pulverized by some maniac who just wants blood and death and false empires. But you think about the past suffering that Jews were subjected to on the hands of the Ukrainians for the last 400 years since the Khmelnytsky rebellion in the late 17th century. I mean, these are, we say torture, I mean brutal, cruel torture. You read the accounts of the Khmelnytsky rebellion, I was just reading the other night, took a pregnant woman, cut open her belly, took out the baby, put a cat inside and sewed her. I mean, just horrible, subhuman barbarism, just disgusting, I mean, like nothing I ever read before. So again, these are the descendants, it's 10 generations later, but Jews have a long history. Again, we should support them, but should also be intellectually honest with yourself. This is an area that led to the mass torture of Jews throughout. You can't have historical amnesia. You have to live with history. You have to make hard decisions in history. Chas v'shalom to say they deserve, but you have to. Life is very sweet. Yeah, Avita, I got your attention.
At what point, like, are you gonna? What about Italians now? Like Roman Empire?
Because it was different.
Modern day
it was
Greece.
Different. It was different. It was different. The same thing. I would have. I'm not saying not to support them. I'm not saying not to send them arms. They're on the right side of history. They're the innocents. They're supporting freedom. This person's a madman. But you have to be honest with yourself. History has a long memory.
But it's not our job to hold them accountable to what their parents did.
I'm not punishing them. Am I taking them? I'm just mentioning that until a country performs tshuva, Germany is trying to perform tshuva.
Yes.
England performed tshuva by taking the Jews back in and supporting the state of Israel. France, partial tshuva. So countries have a chance to rectify the misdeeds of past generations. They haven't. Nothing about Ukraine, aside from taking Jews into Uman every year, has been a kabbar. Now, it doesn't mean we should withhold. I'm not saying you should translate into any decision-making. Mm-hmm. But in terms of sentiments, you have to be honest with yourself and honest with Jewish history. Cool. Otherwise, you amputate yourself from Jewish history. You have to mention that. And I didn't say that they should suffer. I didn't say any of the divine judgment. And nothing of that. But it's hard for me to process it without thinking about Jewish history.
It just seems a bit irrelevant. Like, there's different...
Okay, so that's a question of how deeply you live Jewish history.
No. Not in terms of irrelevant to us. I'm talking about in the context of this Ukrainian-Russian war. Where does Jewish history come into that?
Because...
If you want to talk about Ukrainian, the history of the relationship between Ukraine and the Jewish nation, talking about that in a historical relationship...
I'm going to say one sentence, and then we can continue it later. Because this is obviously something that's got you ignited, and it's obviously something very deep to you, and it's good. I'm happy you have a moral indignance and a political activism, but it's something to think about. I think that a person that lives history very, very deeply, it shouldn't affect, obviously, moral decisions. Right now, there's a moral decision, and those are the innocent people. We should support them. It's not withholding any support and in any way criticizing them. But there's a larger metaphysical, historical narrative that affects not just people, right? So if Hitler was in the room, and I would all say we have to kill him in a prison, whatever. And if someone were to do with Hitler, we'd say, you know what, from a moral, legal, judicial, democratic level. But there's something called a people. And there's something called a people that has tortured the Jewish people. And that's a metaphysical reality that I can't describe in a newspaper article or sociologist. And I would apply the same standards to Rome. And just the same, I'm open to the like I said before, the English people who have rectified some of their sins, even though the prime minister who helped the state of Israel wasn't a descendant of whichever duke. But there's a peoplehood and a collective memory and a collective presence, which is not part of sociology that we study in textbooks, but it's part of something larger that Jews live. And I've been trying to get you into that sphere all year long. Trying to get you into that sphere. Let me share with you something I just told the boys today, the Shir Dalet boys. I have nothing to do with it. We're talking today about a Gemara that alludes to the fact. This is off target, off road, but it will help you understand your point and help you beyond. Not just this point. We're talking about davening without kavanah. There's a Gemara in Brachos that describes that you could say parts of Kriyat Shema without kavanah. Now, don't try this at home. You should say, have as much kavanah as you can possibly. And a lot of Rishonim take that and apply it to our sorry state where we daven without full kavanah. And they try to justify it, even though all the Gemara say, if you don't have kavanah, davening is meaningless and empty. So I spoke with, this is a 10-minute shmuz. And I quoted for them, one of the strategies that I quoted for them to solve davening without kavanah, I quoted the Eish Kodesh. Anyone know who the Eish Kodesh was? The Eish Kodesh, you should really study him and read him and be familiar with him. The Eish Kodesh was a Piechetzner Rav. He was a Hasidish Rav from a long dynasty of Hasidus in Europe, in Poland. And he was a Rav in the Warsaw Ghetto, and he effectively became the de facto Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, certainly for Hasidim, which, again, Poland is at least 60%, 70% Hasidus. Okay, an amazing person. And he continued to give his shiurim, namely not just his Gemara shiurim, but his shmuzin, literally through the darkest, darkest years of the Holocaust. And people being shot in the street, and the war stories, and he's trying to keep it together and hold people together and hold their emunah. It's a fascinating sefer. I can unconditionally recommend you read the sefer. It's called Eish Kodesh. And I'm sure it's been translated into English, but by this point you can probably read the Hebrew. Anyway, one of the ideas he says is as follows. I'm saying this intentionally because I want to get your thinking. Forget your question. I want to get your thinking out of 2023. You have to think of history. You're part of something larger and how a moment is part of a larger moment. So he said, he doesn't say it this way, but he's tackling the following question. It's an interesting question. I raised it a couple months ago. were Holocaust victims, people who you and I would say were Mekadesh Shem Shemayim. Why am I saying that? Rabbi Akiva was Mekadesh Shem Shemayim, because he had a choice. Spanish Jews, Mekadesh Shem Shemayim, they had a choice. Jews who suffered during the Ukrainian Chomeinist rebellion, Mekadesh Shem Shemayim, in theory, had they joined the Christians or the Poles, in some cases, primarily the Ukrainians, they would have had a way out. What made the Holocaust so different, if we just take a few steps back, is for the first time in history, Jews didn't have a way out. There were six or seven markers that made the Holocaust different. One of them was, you were killed whether you wanted to be or not. There was no fleeing ideology. You didn't say, I'm going to convert to Christianity. It didn't help you. Okay? So, in theory, maybe, and that's, I'm not the first person to raise this question, it's a very touchy issue, by the way. It's one of the issues that gets swept under the carpet. Because every Yom HaShoah, Kiddush Hashem, Kiddush Hashem, Kiddush Hashem, they just got caught in the crossfire. At what point is it no longer Kiddush Hashem? Right? Even a secular Israeli who gets killed in the army here, they've made a choice to be Jewish. They've made a choice to put their life on the line because of their Judaism. If you're stuck in Poland in 1939, you just, bad luck. You just get stuck in the wrong place at the wrong time. So, it's a very, very touchy issue, and there are many, many ways to solve it. And this is a very imaginative one, and I'm saying it for that reason. The Eish Kodesh says that the source of all Kiddush Hashem, of all Jewish martyrdom, is the Akedah. That's why that story is so iconic. Akedah Yitzchak. Now, the Akedah Yitzchak had the will to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim, the interest, the willingness for Jewish martyrdom, but it's never came to fruition because HaKadosh Baruch Hu halted it. Right? But Yitzchak and Avram were ready. And the Malach says, Al tishech yad chalana v'tas lamum. So in the language of the Eish Kodesh, they had the Kavanah without the Maisa. That means that throughout history, Jews who have the Maisa without the Kavanah, it's a composite Kiddush Hashem. Because we're part of the Akedah. So even if you're a Jew in Poland and you had the Maisa, you were killed without the Kavanah because you didn't really care to be, well, you're still part of this lineage. Very, very provocative idea. Now, I'm saying this to you. What do you mean? Like, I wasn't at the Akedah. I never talked to Yitzchak. What does it mean? If, yes, but that's emotionally, psychologically. But if you live metaphysically and historically, you are part of it. And you see yourself as possessing that DNA and coming from Avram. And something that you're not gonna all of a sudden trace, oh, my mother taught me this or my father taught me this. But there's something that affects my identity that's larger than me. In a very, very deep and subterranean and primordial level. And part of what we're trying to get you to do, and I'm not so sure there's such a good job here because so much here is intellectual. There's a deep primordial Judaism. There's something very deep about being a Jew, about memory. And you're a bubby who never opened a text in her entire life, but sit to Hillam, you know, probably three times a day, not knowing a word she was saying, but knew she was Jewish, was proud that she was Jewish, and raised a Jewish family. And there's something that draws you that it's hard to describe. So, and it's not just something which affects Jews, some which affects, I've talked about anti-Semitism before. So I'm trying in this classroom to get you to just walk out of contemporary empiricism and social forces and living in the concrete world of political activism to know something that's part of something that's much larger than ourselves, a larger narrative and a larger story. And that was part of the answer to my question. Let's move on because we have a lot to discuss. Okay, so at this point, how did we get to this conversation? Because I mentioned the Kastiim. The Kastiim were the mercenaries. Every great army needs mercenaries. You always need someone to do your dirty work. In the mid-ages, the strongest army was completely mercenaries, Phoenicia. Venice had a strong army, very small population. They were very wealthy. They hired all the thugs from Asia to come and be in their army. So they were a very, very wealthy army, which is why, of course, they were always the gateway for epidemics. Because they were bringing people in from Asia who were hanging out with animals and had all these viruses that jumped from the animal kingdom to the human realm, which we know happens from time to time, and it was like the gateway of viruses. Any epidemic went through the Italian Alps and made its way to Europe. So that's why it was like a hotbed for terrible epidemics. So Phoenician medical history isn't great. Commercial history, mercantile history, a little bit better. Anyway, the Greeks had their own mercenaries. Hitler, Yimach Shemach, Herz mercenaries. Putin has his mercenaries, the Wagner Group. Every army that wants to terrorize, because an army has to be organized, and part of organization is hierarchy, and part of hierarchy is authority, and part of authority is morale. It's So if you have an organized army, there's going to be accountability. People are going to act within certain limits. There's going to be a police. There's going to be accountability. If you're in the Israeli army, let's say, and you act out of line and you unilaterally abuse some prison or something, you're going to be called to task because the army has to operate on discipline. You can't just have people lone wolfing, or else you'll lone wolf in the heat of the battle. You'll shoot your friend. But if you really want to terrorize, you have to subcontract terror and brutality out to mercenaries. That's why you have the mercenaries. So the Kasdim were the mercenaries. And Yiriyah, getting back to Lamed Beis, tells HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not all of the ramparts built, but HaKasdim, HaNilchamim Aleha, they've been afflicting us, line number 3 from the bottom, Bipnei HaCherev, V'Harav, V'Hadever, Asher Dibart, this sounds like Parshas Kisavo. All these scenes of the Tochacha are happening. Line number 2 from the end, now Yiriyah turns to Hashem and says, V'ata Amarta, and you're telling me, K'nei Lecha Hasada Bekesef, V'ha'ed Edim, V'ha'er Nitna B'yad HaKasdim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I get it all. I know I can't know you, but this is one step too far. This is empty. It's an empty action. The place is ablaze. I'm purchasing a burning house. Imagine your house is on fire and someone's going to offer you money. Oh, sure. Yeah. Let's get the contract. Let's get the lawyers. I don't know. I'll take $10. My house is about to become ashes. What, you Paraduma, man? You won't put ash at it? You're buying burning homes. And what does Hashem tell Yirmiyah? He gives him a four-letter password to Google. Today, most passwords have to be 7 letters or more with an extra symbol and a pretty simple password. There's an urban legend. It's probably not true, but it's a great legend. Like 20 years ago, the Israelis were trying to crack into Bashar Assad's Gmail account, president of Syria. And they're the greatest minds who are trying to crack at the code with all sorts of algorithms feeding in all sorts of information. And then some guy in the room got up and said, it's too good to be true, but somebody in the room got up and said, this guy's a moron. We have to think like a moron. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, bam, they got into the Gmail account. I can't imagine that being true, but it's a great story. Sometimes in life, when you're trying to defeat a moron, you have to think like a moron. You can't bring your own set of circumstances when you're trying to defeat people who just have nothing going on upstairs. Anyway, so getting back to Yirmiyah. So what does Hashem tell Yirmiyah? Here's the password for Gula. Hine, ani Hashem elokeik al basar, hamimeni, this is a rhetorical question, hamimeni yipolei kol davar. You think it's ridiculous. You think it's stupefying. You think it's completely, completely incredulous. Is there anything that to me is a pella? You see a burning city. I see, Hashem says, everything that we see outside. Human beings are limited in their sweep. That's why artificial intelligence is going to beat us at some point, because we can't process that much information. Don't get me sidetracked today. I got a lot to say about it.
I have a lot of questions.
Most of it positive, by the way. Mostly positive for religion, I believe. But how much can we process? So I'm trying to stretch your minds to get you to process more than just the 20 years you've lived on this earth. The more that I can stretch your historical sweep, the healthier you'll be as a Jew. I can promise you that. You know, just live in the moment. Living in the moment is a recipe for sin. Sin is always a barter of the moment for eternity. Whether it's future or past. If you live with historical continuity, then the moment is something larger and the needs of the moment are smaller. They shrink. If you live in the moment, then the needs are really powerful and you need two and finish the sentence. If you live historically, historical continuity, verticality, then the needs of the moment pale in comparison to larger historical magnitude. So Hashem tells you and me, yeah, you see a burning city, I see 1948, I see 1967, I see whatever is waiting us in the future. You can't process it. To you, it seems like a mystery because you have limited exposure. I see the full picture, obviously, I'm the omniscient, and there's nothing that's appellate to me because 5,000 years seems like a long, long time. You know what? It isn't. At some point in our experience, we're going to live more than 5,000 years, not on this earth, but I can promise you in 30 billion years, we'll all see each other in heaven. And say, remember when we met in Earth? What was it, like 20 billion years ago? We were like first grade summer camp. What did we have on our heads? We had something called, what was it? my hair, right? And like stringy little things that came out, got all oily. Forgot about that, right?
That's coming to heaven.
We have a thing called hair, heads and hair, because it's going to feel so odd, because we'll forget what heads are, and hair, and bodies, and food, and clothing, and shopping, and all that will be one funny asterisk that we'll laugh about, like you laugh about your holiday vacation when you're second grade, because it's so far ago, and you look so odd in the pictures. And that's how we'll feel about this world. And 5,000 years will be a hiccup. Now, again, we probably won't have time in heaven, so it's not like we'll have 20 mil just in heaven, you know, live in time. And I can't explain that to you because I've never lived outside of time. But heaven is totally different. And either all of us are totally different than our world. And here's the punchline, girls. Geula will always be irrational. Geula will always be unpredictable. Geula will always be illogical, always be mysterious. It is precisely the irrationality of Geula that makes it redemptive. Because human beings try to redeem their world as best they can. And when they come up short, as we inevitably do, Hashem comes and redeems it beyond our capability. Beyond our capability means it's irrational. If we're irrational, we do it. Hashem compliments whatever installments we provide, whatever little redemption we could bring to this world, we're going to come up short. Hashem still wants us to try as best we can not to come up short. But when we come up short, Hashem's going to come and finish the job for us, and the job that he finishes is going to transcend human ration, human comprehension. So it's not as if redemption is, oh, by the way, we thought it'd be comprehensible, we thought it'd be logical and rational. Unfortunately, in circumstances being as they are. Built into Geula is that it's always going to be different. It's always going to be something which defies the human mind. And that's why it's so hard for so many people that are good at rational Judaism to really understand redemptive Judaism. Because it's a different set of processes. You can spend years and years and years and years in yeshiva and know exactly how long the tzitzis have to be, and know exactly how much matzah to eat, because halacha and the study of halacha is a rational system. New information, categories, principles, details, it all fits in. Redemption is not a rational process. And to say something strange, but trying to understand what I'm about to say, redemption is a song. It's closing your eyes and hearing a song. It's musical. It's poetry. It's not rational. Who's singing that song? Jews for thousands of years. What are they singing? We stand tall, and one day we'll come back. And they're singing in different languages and in different cadences and different levels of pride, but it's a song you hear. We've been singing, and we've been yearning, and now we're back, and now 5 million, 6 million Jews have come to our country. And how do you prove a song? How do you prove that song? It's a different set of processors than learning halacha and learning gemara, where you're essentially using your ration, and you're quantifying, and you're applying, and you're describing, and you're deconstructing, and it's a whole different set of tools. And it's an irrational process. It's a historical instinct. It's hard for me to describe it because it's not a rational process. It's an echo. It's closing your eyes and hearing your grandmother. And you hear your grandmother, she's dead. No, it's closing your eyes and hearing. So he's studying Jewish history. Where did I come from? What am I part of? That's what I said before, feeling it. I'm not interested in changing my policy about the Ukrainians, but I have to at least feel what happened 400 years ago and live it and process it and study it and understand it and not avoid it. Gullus should not be avoided. If you avoid Gullus, you're not prepared for Geula. You can't just excise it from our collective memory. It was torture, it was painful. Baruch Hashem, we're back. It's not just, I don't want to say any cliche, if you don't suffer, you don't deserve the joy. That's silly. It's second grade. If you don't eat your pudding, you can't have Pink Floyd. It's not that. It's Jewish history is a continuum. And you will not notice Geula unless you're part of that continuum. And part of the continuum was Gullus. And what did we do in Gullus? How did we survive in Gullus? How did we thrive in Gullus? So that was the first prophet, the first Nabi that received that message. The second Nabi to receive the message was Zechariah. Zechariah is a very, very apocalyptic sefer. If you're into apocalypse, read Zechariah. You'll see horsemen. You'll see four carpenters and seven shepherds and four, all sorts of bodies inhabiting heavenly space, golden candelabras hovering in space. If that's your thing, read Zechariah. Maybe Yechezkel, Zechariah, a little bit of Daniel. Those are your go-to svarim if you're a Mrs. Apocalypse. You want to read about the apocalypse. What do I mean apocalypse? Ideas about Geula that are beyond the current order. Right, a pasuk in Yeshayah that says, we'll have a king who will restore us to Yerushalayim and bring karbanos. Okay, like we can wrap our heads around that. It's just basically returning to what we had. When you have apocalyptic visions where everything will be turned upside down, the planets will be ransacked, and visions and apparitions, and of course, Geula lies somewhere at the intersection between the here and now and the unknown different world order. Right? How apocalyptic will Mashiach be? There are different statements. Shmuel says, Ein bein. That's a very minimalistic view, which the Rambam adopted, but it's going to remain the same. Okay, that's what some people feel. Others feel the whole world's going to change. Everyone's going to see Hashem and gather in Yerushalayim and beat their arms into plowshares. So it's a much more apocalyptic Nebuah. So Zechariah is filled with apocalypse. Now, why am I telling you this? Because get ready to read his most apocalyptic vision. Now I got your attention. Okay? This is the most strange vision in Zechariah. This is so different than anything you'd expect. Here it is. Source 5. Kamar Hashem Tzivakos. Od Yeshivu Zekenim Zekenos Berchovos Yerushalayim. Old people will sit in Yerushalayim on benches. V'ish Mishanto B'yado Merov Yamav. And those be so old, they'll just have to carry canes because they can no longer walk. Berchovos Ayim Alu Yiladim V'ladas Mesachkim Berchovos Ayim. You know this in the Torah, right? Little children will fill the streets and frolic. Girls. What is so apocalyptic about this? I fooled you. I tricked you. These are the beautiful pastoral scenes. They play out in every country in the world. Older people, close your eyes and imagine older people strolling through a park on a warm summer evening. Little children frolicking at the first hint of fall, playing in the leaves. We all know these scenes. They're normal. They're not apocalyptic. The answer is, what's normal for every country and for every nation, for every race, is apocalyptic for the Jewish people because our history isn't normal. And how long have we waited for these visions to actually be fulfilled? Because throughout Jewish history, it was very rare to find an old man and an old woman carrying their canes because they could no longer walk in public because they never made it that long. Because they were killed before they even could sniff 60 or even imagine carrying a cane. And you know what? We're there, but we're still not there because little children can't play freely in the streets of Metula and Kiryat Shmona because there are rockets. And they can't play freely in the streets of Otef Aza, the communities near Aza. And at this point, basically, at any place in Eretz Israel when our bloodthirsty enemies want to shower us with missiles. So it's still elusive. And then Hashem says something even more hyperbolic and more shocking. Hashem says, Ko amar Hashem Tzivakos. Here's our word again. Ki yipalei be'enei she'eris ha'amazes, source 5. Those who will live to see redemption will be shocked, they'll be mystified. Yipalei, remember? Gam be'ena yipalei, Hashem says. You ready for the biggest hyperbole in all of Tanakh? I'll also be shocked. Girls, that's theologically impossible. Shem can't be shocked. Surprise! Make a birthday. Shem can't be shocked. He knows everything. Can't shock Hashem. Shem knows everything. Because obviously, Hashem is hyperbolizing. I'll also be shocked by these scenes that are so unexpected because Jews have faced such hatred throughout history. And once again, Zechariah is being taught that the four-letter password to understand Geula is Yud, Pei, Lamed, Aleph. It's actually a three-letter password. Pei, Lamed, Aleph, which is the source of the mystery, but Yipalei is a conjugation, three- or four-letter password. Google is a little less precise than Google. Google, you got to get exactly right. Geula, right? One day, Google will turn to Geula. You're going to search Google instead of searching Google. Google will have all the answers. So you can enter your Geula account, you can write either the three-letter password or the four-letter password. Right, Pei Lamed Aleph or Yud Pei. We all share the same account, of course. That's what makes Geula so collective. Nothing private about Geula. We all live through the same process together, but we all enter the same account. Geula.org. And Hashem tells it. Rav Amital told us that when he used to walk to his yeshiva and give up Mordechai, he learned in the Chevron Yeshiva. The Chevron Yeshiva was a continuation of one of the great yeshivas in Europe in the pre-World War I and World War II era. It's called the Slabatka Yeshiva. It was probably, after Volozhin, the second most superpower yeshiva in Europe. And he used the word superpower twice. Number one, because of how powerful and prominent it was. Number two, because they seeded, S-E-E-D-E-D, they seeded a lot of the small yeshivas in the area. They were almost a missionary yeshiva. They sent a couple of boys out to go start a yeshiva in this town. So they're the earliest Lakewood. Let's start a Lakewood Kollel here and a Lakewood Kollel there. And since the earliest, let's create sections of our yeshiva. The Volozhin yeshiva was a stay-at-home place. It was one Volozhin. Came and lived in Volozhin, you stayed. You came and you stayed. You went to Slobodka, at a certain point, the Mashgiach was the Altus, was, you know what? You're a pretty good guy. Get a couple other guys and go to Slutsk and go to Minsk and start a yeshiva there. And that's Rav Aaron Kotler, who founded Lakewood, who founded the Solithos. He actually was not just a member of the Slobodka yeshiva, but he actually was one of the 14 boys who went, I think it was to Slutsk or something in the 20s to start a yeshiva. So it was in his DNA. So when he came and founded Lakewood, he was already like, yeah, I know how to do this. I already did it in Europe before the war. So anyway, this is yeshiva of Slabatka, which moved to Hebron in the early 20s. Not all of them, but a branch of them moved to Hebron, and they founded the modern Israeli version of the Slabatka yeshiva, which they called Hebron. Unfortunately, as we said, wrong place, wrong time. They were, unfortunately, after the riots and the pogroms of 1929, they had to move to Yerushalayim. So the remaining members of the Hebron yeshiva, many of whom were killed in the pogrom, moved to give up Mordechai, where the current Hebron yeshiva is. Hebron yeshiva is a fascinating part of the Haredi world. I don't have time to talk about it now, but it's like the Asian effect, right? You go to Asia, oh, they all look the same to me, right? Because they all slant the eyes, right? And you look all the same to them because you all have white skin. So Haredim look all the same, and people don't have any ability to differentiate between Haredim, Hasidim, different branches of Haredim, different branches. They're not all one people. It's not they all get together and say, what should we do? What should our policy be? It's a very, very large mass of different people, different attitudes, different stuff. There are commonalities. Like, we have commonalities, even though we're different. So the Haredi yeshiva is a fascinating yeshiva. It's where Avraham Mital learned after he escaped the war. He lived in Givat Mordechai, and he would walk to the yeshiva every day and pass by a playground. And he would watch the little children playing, and he would stand there transfixed for hours, just crying and thinking about this nevuah. Because the same eyes that had witnessed little children being rounded up and shot in dark forests were now witnessing the nevuahs of Zechariah emerging, little children playing in the streets. And Zechariah understood the same message of Geula that Yirmiyah had to learn, that redemption is irrational, it's asymmetrical. Because it's redemptive, because it's a shift in history, because it's a break in history, because it's Hashem redeeming history. I don't expect, unless Mashiach comes tomorrow, I don't expect tomorrow to be asymmetrical with today, because I'm a human being and I live continuity. So each day is similar to the day before, slightly different. Shabbos is significantly different, but obviously my experience doesn't differ from day to day. When you have a shift into a different realm, the Messianic era, then it's not something you can predict or chart, or it's not going to accommodate your neatly packaged exit. It's not a sine curve for you mathematicians. You know, this neatly undulating sine curve where you can trace. It's jagged. It's bizarre. It's all over the graph because it's Geula. And I'll just end. The person who wasn't a prophet but who had prophetic instincts just lived after the period of prophecy because he was an outsider. And a fresh set of eyes are always important. You want to see someone who sees something from a different angle. It would be Akiva. He was actually the son of a ger, so he was a double outsider. Not only was his father not a Jew, but he was also someone that didn't study for the first part of his life, so he was able to see things from different perspectives. So we all know the story, the shell of the story, but very few people pay attention to the content of the story. So I'll repeat the shell, just so everyone knows what we're talking about, point of reference, but then we'll dig down and get down to the details of the story. What's the shell of the story? The shell of the story is the last Gemara in Makos, Rabbi Akiva and the Chachamim are walking over the ruins of the Beis HaMikdash. They see a fox scampering by. They start crying. He starts laughing. Why are you crying? Look at our Beis HaMikdash. Why are you laughing? Geula's around the corner. Okay, we all know that story. You heard it in camp when you were in ninth grade. Now let's dig under the hood and see exactly what happened in that conversation. Okay? Source number 6. Line number 6. I'll spare you all the intro. That's just the shell. Here's the details. Now we're getting to the nitty-gritty, the nuts and bolts. What does he say? L'chein ani mitzachek. Source 6, line 6. Dechsev. There's, okay, now you have to follow 3 psukim. Okay, you didn't get this in 9th grade because you just got the story on Tisha B'Av. Now you're in Migdalos. You know how to read text. Now let's actually read what the Gemara says in the text. There are 3 psukim in Tanakh that are being aligned now. One pasuk is a pasuk in Yeshaya Perkhas, in which Yeshaya juxtaposes the nevuos of 2 Nevi'im who didn't live contemporaneously. So that already gets our attention. What does Yeshaya say? V'aida, this is line number 7. V'aida li edim ne'manim, I will call to testify 2 trustworthy witnesses, es Uriah HaKohen v'es Zechariah ben Berechiah. Got it? These are the 2 witnesses that Yeshaya. Now let's put Yeshaya on the side. Yeshaya is not part of the conversation anymore. But all of a sudden, there's something similar between Uriah and Zechariah. If Yeshaya is mentioning them in the same sentence, evidently they've got something in common. What do you mean? Uriah lived during the first Beis HaMikdash. Zechariah lived in the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. Who in their right mind, namely Yeshaya, were mentioned in the same sentence? They were separated by a couple hundred years. We don't know the exact details, but... So why would Yeshaya be juxtaposing Uriah HaNavi and Zechariah HaNavi? Because the content of their nevuah, not the timing and the chronology of their nevuah, was antithetical and thereby related through antithesis. Because Uriah was the Navi we spoke about, the rats and the foxes scampering over the Beis HaMikdash. And Zechariah was the one who talked about children playing in the streets of Yerushalayim. Now let's read. I sliced it up for you nicely. Uriah b'mikdash Rishon, line number 8, v'Zechariah b'mikdash Sheni. Uriah talks about how terrible Yerushalayim will dilapidate. L'chein b'glalchem tzion tzadech t'charen. She'll be plowed over like a field. B'Zechariah k'siv, Zechariah wrote, Og yesh v'zekenim v'zekenos b'rchavos Yerushalayim, our psukim that we just read a moment ago. Now Rabbi Akiva says, now Rabbi Akiva is talking. He knows Yeshaya. He knows that Yeshaya put them together. He knows that Yeshaya is referring to this nevuah of Uriah about the foxes and the rats and dilapidated Beis HaMikdash. And Zechariah's nevuah that Yeshaya was referring to was about the children playing in the streets. And he says, Rabbi Akiva, here's his point. Here's his logic. Ad shelo niskaima nevuaso shel Uriah. Before Uriah's nevuah was fulfilled, I saw the rats and the foxes. I was afraid Zechariah. Maybe Zechariah's nevuah won't come true. Now that I see the fox and the rats, I'm sure that Zechariah's nevuah will come to fruition. Nechamtanu nechamtanu. What's Rabbi Akiva's logic here? Why are these nevuahs interdependent? Why would you not be sure about the triumph nevuah until you witness the tragic nevuah? Just because they're in the same pasuk? There's something deeper that correlates these 2 nevuahs. Not just, oh, Yeshaya happened to mention them together, so they must be interdependent. Akiva is seeing something. There's logic behind it. It's not just arbitrary and capricious. Rabbi Akiva is listening to the shir. I mean, I heard one of Rabbi Akiva. Rome conquered many different cultures. But they didn't emasculate the cultures they conquered, because that's not a recipe for building a big empire. A recipe for building a big empire is killing a few thousand, raping a few hundred women, and then allowing that culture to sustain itself and its rights and its religion and its leadership as long as they deliver 2 items to the Roman Empire that are absolutely crucial for empire perpetuating. Money, you have a lot of taxes, and soldiers. If you don't have money and soldiers, you can't build an empire. You can't beat the barbarians. So Rome went around the world, conquering and conquering. You have to subjugate, you have to terrify, you have to show your might, a couple hundred. But then, okay, keep your community intact across the Mediterranean, and every year, our Roman official will show up, and you better deliver 5 chests of gold coins and 200 soldiers to go to the war in France, Calabria, or whatever. There was only one nation whose temple they ransacked, whose artifacts they brought back to Rome, celebrating and hooting, whose leadership they brutally tortured and murdered and burned and cut their... Yeah, that's like, why? Why was our history so different? Why was our treatment so different than all the other empires? And in a way, it was counterintuitive, kind of productive. We're pretty good soldiers, the Jews. In fact, recent archaeology has uncovered, Parsha Shlach a little bit earlier, the average Jew in Israel was actually taller and stronger than the average Roman. Because when Israel was a prophetic land, then it was a Vashalav Devash. It wasn't Eretz Achelos Yoshveh, it was Eretz Achila Yoshveh. And that could be Eretz Achelos Yoshveh, there are giants there. The giants, because they were still holdovers when the land was still producing at divine supernatural pace. So I'm a Roman. I want these Jews on my side. I want to kill them. I want to subjugate them and then draft them. You don't subjugate and draft them if you're going to completely empty Yerushalayim and empty Israel, as they did eventually. It was because of the hatred for the Jews and because Jewish history is asymmetrical and disproportionate and we're different because we're the Am Hashem. And you can't graft Jewish history to any other nation. Hen Am Levadad Yishkon, V'agayim Lo Yishchashav. Light bulb moment. Oh, now I realize Jewish history is different. By seeing Uriah's Nevuah come true, that our temple has been turned into a field of foxes and scoundrels and rats. Oh, okay, I get it. Jewish history is asymmetrical, it's disproportionate. So who will it be? So, because the same disproportion that affects our low moments that Uriah prophesied about, that he and his colleagues were witnessing, will also mean that we can turn around in a bat of an eyelash. We can go from 1945 to 1948 in ways that totally defy human anthropology. And you go from 45 to 48. And that's when Rekiva said, oh, now I get it, because Jewish history is a Pella. So now I'm ready for Zechariah's Nevuah that Komar Hashem, Im Yipolei B'nei Shiretz HaMazeg, Gam B'nei Yipolei Rom Hashem. It wasn't Rabbi Kiva just happened to hear about Yeshaya, who happened to juxtapose two Nevi'im, even though they weren't contemporaneous. Oh, now I see the foxes. No, Rabbi Kiva was digging down into Yeshaya. Why would Yeshaya put these two Nevi'im together? Because he sensed a common brand, a common theme in Uriah's Nevuah and in Zechariah's Nevuah. Common theme is Jewish history is just going to be totally out of whack. And we're going to sink precipitously. And when we rise, we're going to rise meteorically. Because it's all just a pella. And that is a good way to end this section. Don't expect Geula to be by number. Sequential. Logical. It's not. And you have to dig into a deeper part of yourself to experience Geula. I'm working really hard this summer to write a book on it because I just feel like there's so little out there for people to actually read. Not ideological. It's such an ideological topic that you end up basically believing in what you want before you actually read what you need to believe in. Rather, let's just read material. Think about issues and discuss issues. And rather, just flag waving or ideology announcing and megaphone broadcasting. This is what we believe in. It's become ideological color war. And who's going to convince the other side of their right? Rather than let's study this topic and let's think about it and again, I've given you this, the sunny side of Geula. There's also what Gullus was and what the challenges of Geula were. I just had a few streamlined classes. Okay, as you can see by my attire, I've got to get to a simcha. Okay, white shirt at simcha time. Okay, so got to get. Is this our last class?
But about to ask you about that. There's going to be, like, of us here, at least seven are here till the end of the year.
Okay, great. So we'll continue. In fact, if you girls want, you can come to my house for a share. Get Esty to get you a bus or something. We'll order some pizza. We'll have take selfies for all the girls who are missing it. Give them FOMO.
Okay.
It's all recorded. But you got to get Esty to sign off on the bus.